On this episode of Skeptico.
Whether you're talking about an Islamic fundamentalist, a Christian fundamentalist, a libertarian fundamentalist, they all have a lot of the same structures.
Well, that's because they're all based on these cultish kind of principles.
Exactly.
That are extremely scary. And until, you know, that's the part that I feel like is often missing from the public discourse is it's cultish, folks. We understand how mind control works. We understand how different groups in our society are trying to manipulate other groups. And some of those are in a religious kind of framework. Some of them are outside of that, and some of them are somewhere in between, like Scientology. No one thinks Scientology is a religion, but clearly they're practicing all the same, pushing the same buttons in terms of cultish practices.
It's wrong, not even just because it's correct or incorrect, you know, corresponding to reality, but because of the way it defends itself, because of the way it perpetrates itself.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. As you know, I have been pretty hard on atheists over the years, and that's because I think in terms of the big picture questions, who are we, why are we here, the atheistic dogma that we usually hear leaves those folks on the outside looking in without much to really contribute to those interesting questions. But on the other hand, I am drawn to the atheist position in terms of these kind of outsiders who are willing to challenge the religious existing dogma that still casts a huge shadow, not only on our culture, but on the personal lives of many, many people. So when I heard that today's guest, David Fitzgerald, prominent atheist and biblical scholar, if you will. I hate when people revolt when people say biblical scholar. He's enough of a biblical scholar for me. But when I saw that he had a new book, I was anxious to get him on. It's taken a couple months in the making to make that happen. And I know it kind of follows a bunch of other shows that I've done on Christianity, but that's okay. That's just the way it came out. I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk to Dave. Here is that interview. Today we welcome David Fitzgerald to Skeptico. David is an atheist activist, a biblical history researcher, and a very accomplished public speaker. I do encourage you to check out some of his excellent YouTube presentations that you'll easily find if you search for his name. Dave is also the author of several books, including one that he's here to talk about today, Jesus, Mything in Action, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. It sounds a little daunting, but it's really not. And one more thing. While I'm sure that Dave would appreciate you buying those three volumes on Amazon, I have to mention that if you have Kindle Unlimited, like my wife does, and I kind of cipher off her account there, you can actually read those books for free. So, Dave, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So you were just chatting a minute ago, but let me set this up for listeners. Skeptico is primarily a show about consciousness science, but that has led us into looking at spirituality and controversial spirituality and Christian apologetics. But since we've done a lot of that lately, what I'm hoping we can do, because I have a real live atheist activist on this show, is not only talk about your excellent books and what you bring to those books, which I think is really great because you have kind of a unique angle and a unique way of kind of talking about this stuff. But I'm hoping we can also pull back a bit and talk about some of the bigger picture stuff surrounding atheism. And it sounds like you're okay with that.
Yes. Well, at least I will be until we start talking, and who knows what'll happen. Go for it.
Good. Great. So let's start with the basics. You know, your bio, who you are, tell folks a little bit about that, and then let's talk about these really cool books.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I began life as a very devout Southern Baptist, and that informed all my Christianity growing up. And then, this is certainly the super long story, super short. In my college era, in my college years, I had a what I call a secular epiphany when this one girl who I used to flirt with by having theological arguments with asked me, well, Dave, you know, the Hindu religion is like 3,000 years older than Christianity. And I thought for a minute and I was about to answer back and go, no, it's not. Oh. And I realized I had no idea whether Hinduism was older than Christianity or not at the time. And it turns out it's quite older. But that realization that I was about to say something I didn't know was true or not shook me to my core. And people talk about how they lost their Christianity over, you know, got dragged kicking and screaming and incrementally went away from it. I can remember the moment I was a Christian and the moment I was no longer a Christian. It was that realization that I was just parroting what I'd always been taught. And I was no better than the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons that I was always begging about.
That's really cool. That's a cool, you know, most people that there isn't that clarity, but that's really awesome.
It's so funny because it just changed my whole outlook on the world. And ironically, I became so much more Christ-like in my love for everybody and my acceptance of everybody once I gave up Christianity. And so that was for the next 16 years. That was me. I was not quite an atheist activist yet. I was on my way to becoming an atheist activist. And around 2000 or so, I read a terrific book by a guy named Ken Smith called Ken's Guide to the Bible. And it left me with all these great questions about who Jesus really was and what he really said, because you get all these different pictures of who Jesus is when you read different gospels. And so long story short, you know, I wanted to parse out what was the real Jesus, what he really said, and what was just the legendary bullshit that got accumulated on afterwards. And very long story, very short, the first things that happened to me was all these red flags started going up as if to say, you know, this is all the evidence we have, and this is the quality of that evidence. And so about 2 years later, I was thinking, yeah, I don't think this guy existed at all. And that's how I became a mythicist. And that's sort of where my troubles began, because I wrote a book in 2010 called Nailed. And the subtitle was 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. And that's pretty much blown up in a way I never expected to. It's really fascinating to me that I'm still writing about Jesus mythicism 15 years after reading that book, 10 years, you know, almost 10 years after writing my first book. But there's just so much to be said about it.
Well, there is. There is a lot to be said about it. And it is interesting, too, from a personal standpoint. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. I mean, you reached a point that I'm sure many, many, many people reach in the kind of the, I always call it the how can this be moment. Or, right?
Yes.
Right? Right? So it's like, okay, I get the data. I get that this Christian narrative just doesn't hold up in some real, and that, you know, like so many people even go to seminary and are devout Christians, but then they study it and they go, oh my God, you mean all us insiders really know that?
Yeah.
But then you took it this next step. You couldn't let it go. And I can definitely relate to that. I mean, that's me. You're like, no, wait a minute. I'm not just going to pack this in and then just go on merrily with my life. What is that about? What does that say about you? And what? How do you understand that?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I blame my emergent Christianity in my formative years for a lot of things. But one thing it did was it was constantly talking about defending the truth and the truth of the gospel and the truth of Christianity. And when you realize, yeah, that's not true, it's like I didn't lose my respect for the truth,
zeal,
and my devotion,
yeah,
my zeal for the truth. But now it's – and one of the things that drove me crazy and made me want to write the book is doing the research for it. You'd constantly come across Christians, you know, biblical scholars saying something that's completely – diametrically opposed Christianity, and then saying, but of course there was a real Jesus and blah, 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 and then backing away and touching the totem pole to make sure everyone knows they're still on board. And just seeing the mental gymnastics that they would go through to try to explain away these things that are obvious signs that we're talking about a fictional character, an allegorical character, and that the gospel writers intentionally expected their audience to recognize that they were allegorical characters.
Yeah. And then so now you've, again, that book, Nailed, was super well received, very successful book. Now you've followed it up with this latest, Jesus Mything in Action. And I love the approach that you've taken with it, but tell people, you know, what was calling you forward to use some kind of religious expression there.
Sure. When I wrote Nailed, it was just pointing out the top 10 ways that the official story of Christianity just does not pass the reality test. And I even had a chapter at the end saying, "Can Jesus be saved?" where I talked about this is all the ways Christianity and early Christian history would have to be different for me to even be comfortable saying that there was actually a guy named Jesus. And I thought that was the end of it. I think that's all that had to be said. But what really surprised me was how much blowback I got from certain atheist groups who were just convinced that not only, there was a real Jesus, but it's stupid to think there wasn't a Jesus. It's insane. And for the longest time, it bugged the hell out of me why I was getting such vociferous. I mean, I didn't expect everyone to agree with me. That's nothing special. But the amount of hostility towards it just really shocked me until I figured out that they were taking all the red flags that they get from people who are anti-vaxxers, from people who deny the moon landing happened, climate change denialists, all those red flags that went up for them, they had lumped in Jesus denial with that. And so I wrote Mything in Action mostly as a response to atheists. It's not really meant to convert Christians because I don't think, you know, it's such – this whole subject of Jesus mythicism is such kryptonite for Christianity that they can't even take a relaxed, you know, let's agree for the point of argument sort of standpoint. They can't give an inch on this.
But hold on. Let's just pull that apart for a minute because I thought that was an interesting point. It comes out early in your book and – I don't know. I get where you're coming from, and there's a worldview gap that sometimes we can't jump. Like, we're probably not going to be being able to jump on climate denier and vax stuff because I'm on the other side of that. I think the data leads you the data to me that I see just leads you completely the opposite direction. But maybe we won't be able to jump that gap. But we're not going to talk about it here because it's another topic. But here's the point: anyone who goes through these kind of transformations of thought, the reason-based, logic-based transformations has to start somewhere. So I kind of think, Jesus, Mything in Action, I think there's a lot of Christians that will read it, maybe, get mad at it and, kind of throw it over in the corner, but, we'll months later or a year later pick that up and it'll, the splinter of the mind kind of thing. We'll kind of stick there and go, that is kind of true. How do I get past that?
And I'll be honest with you. I get stories back to me that has happened. There's a talk I give on sex and violence in the Bible. And a friend of mine said, I brought two Christian friends of mine and they spent the whole time during your talk. And she gave me the look of their mouths agape and staring at the screen. And then 3 days later, she got an email from them and said they'd left their church. And so I know these things do make an impact on Christians, but I was aiming it towards my fellow atheists because, as you know, the atheist community is just as diverse as any other community out there. It's not a monolithic block of anything any more than Christianity or Judaism or Islam is. But I wanted to let them know that, we have good reasons for thinking that there was no Jesus whatsoever.
So we've talked about the pushback that you got from atheists. Maybe let's even explore that a little bit further because, part of that is also an interesting kind of social phenomenon that, we have to have an enemy, you're taking away our enemy. We have all these, I've built all these good arguments for the Thanksgiving table that I can use, and now I have to change.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I remember going back to when I first, when it occurred to me that I was questioning Jesus, that shook me up just as much as losing my religion had 16 years before. So I get how this is a tough sell for people. Here I am still talking about it, 17, 18 years later.
And while we are talking about the pushback from atheists that some people might find surprising, no one's going to find surprising the pushback from Christians. But I think what some folks might not fully appreciate, and I have a little taste of this, is that how nasty that can be. I still get tons of... Not tons is maybe an exaggeration. I get plenty of email, though, from Christians just nasty stuff, and nasty sometimes in just kind of a Christian loving kind of way. Like, you know,
when you're burning in hell.
You exactly. Know? You know, you haven't found God and God is trying to call you. You need to answer, you know, and just very condescending bullshit, you know? And it's like, I think it's easy for people, especially on this show where I can bash atheists a lot for maybe some of the reasons we'll talk about later, is to not appreciate how hard it still is to be an atheist in the United States. And particularly, you know, I live in California, I live in Southern California, you live in San Francisco. I mean, it's considerably easier. Exactly.
Yes.
It's
yes.
considerably easier out here, but for a lot of the flyover United States, I mean, they have no one to talk to.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the wonderful things about the internet is, for atheists anyway, not only are you connected to every other atheist on the planet, even if you're in the middle of Snake Handler, Missouri, you know, in the reddest of the red states, but you can fact check your preacher from the pulpit in real time. It's astounding how erosive and corrosive the effect of all this information sharing is on all these traditional belief structures.
Good. And let's hit a couple of the kind of high points there on that topic of what it's like for personally, on a personal level, for people who maybe start having these doubts about the faith of their childhood, the faith of their family tradition. And because I think it's a real thing that we have to kind of get out there to really understand where a lot of the atheist community is coming from. I mean, there's a certain reality, I think, to the claim that this is abuse, that this is abusive. It's clearly coercive to take little kids and put them and, you know, scare them. Like, I'm talking about personally. I mean, I was raised in a Greek Orthodox church in Chicago, and the intent was to scare the crap out of you.
Yeah.
About
scare the hell out of you, literally. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that still goes on, and we kind of gloss over it a little bit and think, oh, well, it's not really like that. Yeah, no, it's still like that. A lot of kids are still being, you know.
And that's not even getting into the whole Catholic pedophilia scandal. It's like, I as a Southern Baptist, for me, in a lot of ways, I had it really easy. I had an extended family who loved me. It was all our social network. And I think there's a lot of Christians out there who are Christians for good, rational, true reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with Christianity being true or rational or good. But again, I was one of the lucky ones, I think. And at the end of the day, even that wasn't enough for me. Just knowing that it wasn't true was enough for me to say, no, I can't sign off on this. But there's so many people out there whose religion is a nightmare. And as you say, an abusive nightmare on multiple levels, from just telling them something that's not true, inculcating that in generation after generation after generation, the judgmental nature of the idea that you have the one true faith and everybody else, you have to go out like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, going saved, not saved, saved, not saved, and honing in on them and judging everybody by according to how much their belief structures match yours. It's astounding how pervasively pernicious that is. Pardon the alliteration, but it changes your whole outlook on people. And of course, they've done lots of studies about this, about conservative people who are conservative politically, and how whether you're talking about an Islamic fundamentalist or Christian fundamentalist, a libertarian fundamentalist, they all have a lot of the same structures.
Well, that's because they're all based on these cultish kind of principles.
Exactly.
That are extremely scary. And until, you know, that's the part that I feel like is often missing from the public discourse is it's cultish, folks. We understand how mind control works. We understand how different groups in our society are trying to manipulate other groups. And some of those are in a religious kind of framework. Some of them are outside of that, and some of them are somewhere in between, like Scientology. No one thinks Scientology is a religion, but clearly they're practicing all the same, pushing the same buttons in terms of cultish practices. So I think until we fully dig into that and understand how fragile our psychological makeup is and how easily we are manipulated, all of us. I mean, it's just, you know, like we all look back at, if you're old enough like I am, to look back at some old photos and see like the fashion you were wearing going, why the hell did it look ridiculous? Well, there's an element of that where you're just kind of following along because it's kind of feels right and feels good. Any thoughts on the cultish part of this?
I think you nailed it right on the head. It's like it's wrong, not even just because it's, you know, wrong or right, you know, correct or incorrect, you know, corresponding to reality, but because of the way it defends itself, because of the way it perpetrates itself. Daniel Dennett has done a great book called Breaking the Spell, where he talks about all these evolutionary survival mechanisms that religions have co-opted for their own use. And it's fascinating to see how we're dancing with ghosts in all these many ways that we're doing all these things that are meant to prop up this, you know, patriarchal, authoritarian, tribal group. And here it is in the 21st century, and we're still acting like Neanderthals that way.
Yeah. Daniel Dennett is an interesting figure, as he pops up in this show a lot, because Daniel Dennett has famously said that consciousness is an illusion, which is a good lead-in, I think, to some of the other stuff that I wanted to talk about. So let me try and get there by saying, you know, atheism is cool and important from a cultural, social, and just truth-seeking fashion in all the ways that you're talking about. But what always I find kind of hard to resolve, and I guess I pick and poke at atheists a little bit about this, and since you're an atheist activist and I have you here on the show, having this good discussion. But, you know, the link between this debunking of religion and pulling back from the cult and deprogramming, which I totally get.
Right.
And then the link to this, what I think is just kind of crazy, scientific materialism epitomized by Daniel Dennett. I mean, consciousness is an illusion. That's a non-starter. I mean, no one thinks that anymore. That's like so outdated scientifically. Even, you know, Sam Harris, who's kind of an interesting figure in the atheist community because he's kind of on the fence on the consciousness thing, but he always has been very anti-religion, and atheists don't know quite what to make of him. But even Sam Harris says, gee, you think Dan really believes that? Because it's just kind of a crazy idea. And yet I see so many atheists who just dogmatically adhere to this scientific materialism and all the implications of it. And they're like, science, 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 without really digging into understanding what that means and what the implications are. And I don't know how much you've looked into that or what thoughts you have on that, but I'd sure be interested to hear.
Well, for me, you know, if we're agreeing on what scientific materialism is, and I think we are, I don't have a problem with it. It doesn't narrow and restrict my awe of the cosmos and our place in it. If anything, it elevates it to something that I feel like I can be humble and proud at the same time, just filled with the wonder of what we're able to accomplish, what life itself has been able to accomplish, even though much of life is brutish and thuggish, short and horrible and cruel. It doesn't have to be. And people talk about living in a cold, impersonal universe without love. That's not true. We are the love in the universe. There is love in the universe because we have this consciousness. Even if, as Dennett said, our consciousness is, our free will is made up of teeny tiny robots. You know, I kind of love that expression.
Yeah, but it's a truth-seeking thing, Dave. If it's not true, it doesn't matter.
And I couldn't agree more.
Consciousness is an illusion, is not true. It's been falsified over and over again. And that's why I guess is the my gripe with atheists is it's more dogma. So it's like, no, I can't let go of that idea because I've built all this other stuff on it. And it opens up the door to the implications of it are huge, and they're scary in the same way that, you know, they don't like where Sam Harris is going. And I'm not a Sam Harris fan, but at least saying Sam Harris is someone who looks into it and says, wow, well, you know, I really can't put those boundaries on consciousness, and therefore I have to open up to there being the potential of there being some reality to, more broadly, spirituality. But what we're really talking about is some kind of hierarchy to consciousness. So, you know, the brutish life and the Richard Dawkins biological robot stuff, I mean, that's bullshit. It's just not true, you know? So that's my rub, and I don't understand why atheists aren't more interested in trying to wrestle that to the ground, but in the same way that they see like Christians want to do, they're just like, no, that's true. We can't really touch that. Let's just move on to the next topic.
Well, let me just respond very briefly to that with the caveat that, like I said, atheism is just as diverse as anything else on the planet. So I don't pretend to be speaking for all of atheism. And again, it's not even a topic that I'm particularly into, if you will. I mean, I haven't spent a lot of thought on the question of consciousness.
And that's fair, because let me just interject and say that's fair, because I've read your writings and you really don't get into that. So I don't want to kind of
It's like if we don't get back onto historical, you know, what really happened in the first century or the second century, then, you know, my usefulness to the discussion goes down. But I mean, I do have my own opinions, you know, for sure. I don't know. I'm certainly open to the idea of that there's more to consciousness than we think. And yet, at the same time, I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea that whatever consciousness is, it evolved naturally out of our brains, our physical, mental apparatus, if you will. And I just don't have a problem with that, for what it's worth.
Okay, fair
enough. And when spirituality, that's a placeholder for a lot of things. And I'm sure everything that goes under that big tent, you don't hold with either. And maybe I'm just focusing my flashlight on the wrong corners. But when I hear people talk about things like spirituality, and I get a little deeper into what they're talking about, it seems like they're talking about perfectly natural things, emotion things, ideas. Even consciousness to me feels very natural.
So here's the central issue, and I won't pound on it too much, because I think you're totally fair in saying, you know, this isn't something you've written extensively about or something like that. But here's the jumping off point. Daniel Dennett is the perfect jumping off point. Consciousness is an illusion. That dogma.
What does he mean by that? And what's your takeaway from that?
Well, what he means by that is that your sense of you, the voice inside your head, if you will, is not real. It's something that's created by you, but it's merely an illusion. So your sense of you being you is an illusion. And I mean, so that's kind of goofy from just to kind of, you know, you could ask a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old and they're like, no, you know, I'm me, I'm really in here. And I assume you are you and you're really in there. And anything else is just kind of a ridiculousness that isn't even worth talking about. I mean, because there isn't any really you and I talking. But where it really breaks down is scientifically, you know, we know that that's not true because we've done a whole bunch of experiments looking at consciousness. And the most famous is the, you know, the double slit experiment. And does consciousness collapse the wave function? And then there's all the stuff on mind, brain, and placebo, and meditation, and mindfulness, all that stuff comes back again and again and again to say that, gee, you know, whatever consciousness is, it's not an illusion. So then there's other places that all takes you. But
let me just jump in super fast and say, I'm not opposed to what you're saying. I'm not closed to what you're saying. I just don't have enough information to confirm or deny what you're saying at the moment.
Okay. No, fair enough. So I was kind of long-winded there, but I'll come to the point is because where that leads is some really tricky parts for atheists that do kind of directly attack the underpinnings of atheism. And that's that, okay, there is this consciousness, right? It's not an illusion. So what are the limits of that consciousness? When does it begin? When does it end? Does it end at biological death? Is it, as you said, an epiphenomenon of the brain? Is it just something that's created there? Or is consciousness some kind of field that's out there that we're tapping into? Those are all real questions that consciousness researchers are trying to tackle, and science in general is trying to tackle in a number of ways. But one of the sets of data that you get out of that is starts looking like a lot of the religious wisdom traditions. And that is that, oh, there is an order to this consciousness. There does seem to be a hierarchy. There does seem to be a morality that's kind of built into this fabric of the universe that we never imagined was there before. And that's the real rub for atheists. And I think that a lot of people who are pretty smart in the atheist community kind of see that around the bend, and they're trying to cut it off before people really get there and go, no, don't go there, because I know where that leads. And they're just trying to backdoor religion back in. So all I'm doing, Dave, is trying to lay out that that is one of the...
Sure, sure. And I was going to say, just in response to that, I don't know if I see that happening. I definitely see all kinds of fault lines in atheism that we are fighting about now. And some of them are, I think, are more legitimate than others. I don't know if anyone's really slamming the back, you know, slamming the door on that and saying, all right, let's not even go there.
Well, I think it's I've seen, you know, in the last 10 years or so, that there has been a retreat from that kind of strict scientific materialism. So let's take advantage of having you here and follow up on that question.
Okay.
What do you see as some of the trends that are emerging or moving with atheism? The other trend I see is there seems to be the whole skeptic thing has really died down. And it's kind of, not that it isn't there anymore, but it doesn't have the same kind of oomph that it did. What are the trends within the community of folks that you talk to and call your kind
right,
of atheist
my
colleagues?
Tribe, if you will.
Yeah, your tribe, yeah.
Well, I see a lot of the same fracturing that we're seeing just in American society in general in atheism. And especially 2016 just really ripped the country apart in all kinds of ways. And it ripped atheism apart as well. Politically, we are more divided than we ever have been. And I think the break between the people who are disgusted with the Democrats and the liberal wing of politics and the people who are disgusted with the Republicans and the plutocratic side of politics, those divides just went hardcore over Bernie versus Clinton and Trump versus everybody else. And at the same time, gender politics, for lack of a better term, transgender rights, you know, homosexuality, all these things are dividing atheism, just like
really. That's surprising to me. And in what way are they divisive? Because I would think that the kind of free thought kind of vibe there wouldn't be trying to pick apart the kind of people's sexuality and the way that they express
right.
it. How does that work its way into the thing?
What I'm seeing is that we've got factions, for lack of a better word, that don't brook any kind of opposition. You have to be totally on board with us or you're against us. We've got people who, you know, the men's right activist types. We have cognizance of that in the atheist community, where they're just really disrespectful to women, really disrespectful to transgender rights, for instance. And they're proud of it, and they see themselves as, like, you know, defenders of free speech. On the other hand, you've got the exact opposite. We've got the groups that are so entrenched in, you know, what you might call liberal dogma, that if you even question it, if you even say, well, I want to get more information,
you're triggering them.
You're triggering them. Yeah. And I don't want to take away from either side, you know, the right to speak your mind and the right for people to be treated fairly. Both of those things are super important, and somehow we're still divided over them. And I don't really have an answer for that. And I don't think those are specifically atheism problems either. It's just we're kind of a mirror of society.
How do you think the mythicist in particular, if we can focus in on that, since that's been something that you've really focused on so beautifully in your books, how do you think that plays into this, some of these issues for the atheist community in general? Because I think it's really, interesting. And I think you've done a great service by just totally focusing in and saying, you know, this is a lens through which we can look at these larger issues of culture and society and why, you know, we have these, our presidents before they can be elected, whether we believe that they're religious or not, we want them to make this kind of religious statement, you know.
And I want that to go away so hard.
But is it going to go away?
Well, I mean, on one hand, when I was working with the Secular Student Alliance, the reports, you know, from Pew Research, from Barna, from all these different demographic researchers are showing that we are becoming increasingly more irreligious at a younger and younger age. I mean, what I mean by that is the current college age American is far less likely to be religious. And those numbers just keep going up. The last I looked at, it was about a 30-30 split, almost a perfect third split between openly religious, openly secular, and secular, but or religious, but not spiritual, but not religious.
Yeah.
Exactly, and those blow my mind. That was still a couple of years ago, so it's probably even gone up more now. And what was excited about that for me was the GOP has so much power in, because of the religious right, doing lip service to the religious right, that they're invested in this myth. They're invested in this structure, this theological structure. To see that get worn away just delights me. And that's where I focus my work, because A, that's what I'm interested in, and that's B, you know, how I can best, you know, change the world. But I mean, I'm not under any illusions that once we get rid of religion, we're not going to have tons of problems left to figure out. And that's a tough question to answer. You also reminded me of something else when you were talking about the bigger issues of mythicism. And one of the other big surprises for me when I started getting into this whole there was no Jesus business, I was shocked how many ex-Muslims and current Buddhists would contact me and said, you know what? We are having these exact same arguments in our circles too, arguing whether the Buddha was a real person and arguing whether Muhammad was a real person. And that just blew my mind to think that there wasn't a Muhammad until they started telling me the reasons why they thought that. And I thought, oh, wow, this is sounding a lot like Jesus.
Which is really, let's explore that for a minute, because that's exactly what I was trying to put my finger on, is that the mythicism, the process, if you will, that you go through in your books, both Nailed and the latest Jesus Mything in Action, both of them also reveal a process, an analytical process that I think extends beyond just religious studies, but certainly there's a lot of work, a lot of fields to be plowed in religion as well. But do you want to speak to that, of the process that and the analytics that you went through and you think are revealed through that means?
Well, I think I mentioned in the book, I maybe mentioned it Nailed, but it's, if you want to say anything about, you know, just let's say Jesus, for example, what he said and what he did, your first question needs to be, well, what's our sources for that? And your second question needs to be, and how reliable are these sources? And in a nutshell, when you start turning that question on Muhammad, on Buddha, on Zoroaster, on Moses, on Abraham, just about
on Abraham Lincoln or George Washington.
Well, no,
I mean, really?
There's a difference, though. There's a difference, because I am saying that Moses, Abraham, Zoroaster, Buddha, and maybe Muhammad did not exist at all, full stop. There's a difference between somebody like Abraham Lincoln and like the Apostle Paul, who, it was a real person, and yet there's so much gloss of mythicism over them that it's hard to know where the real person starts and stops. But we know there's a real kernel at the center of the core. There is a real person. We don't know that for Jesus. We think the opposite is true for Jesus and all these other major religious figures. So much so that it makes me wonder if people like L. Ron Hubbard and Joseph Smith are the exceptions to major religion starters because they actually were real people.
I totally get your point and don't disagree with it. But I think the parallels are more interesting when you get up to that next level and you look at who L. Ron Hubbard really was and his deep connections, thorough connections, unquestionable connections to military intelligence. Mm. He's out in the desert with Parsons, you know, who is kind of the Mr. Military Intelligence. And he's also connecting with Crowley and, you know, through Parsons, and they think he's great and all the rest of this stuff. Undeniable. And then, you know, we did an extensive show on the whole connection between Scientology and some of the work that was done at Stanford Research Institute under the Stargate program. All those guys, which you don't know about, but I mean, all those guys who were doing that psychic spying stuff, not all of them, but several of the highest level people were deep, deep into Scientology. So I think at that next level up, the process that you've gone through and the analytics that you do, and I think you said it beautifully, you know, who are your sources and how reliable are those sources is kind of step one. But the other thing that I see you do and do quite beautifully, and I really have to pull you out on this and give you my compliments on Jesus Mything in Action. What you do is something that's kind of unique in that you turn this analysis around, because a lot of people are talking, have talked, you know, God, there's thousands of books. I don't know if that's literally true, but on this topic. But you did, you turned it around. You said, okay, let's look at what Christians are most likely to say in kind of a general sense. Give people a sense, and then they'll, I'm not expressing it very well. So give people a sense of some of the myths that you go through in that book. And I think they'll understand what I mean about how you kind of have a different angle of looking at some of these questions.
Yeah. There's kind of two parts to that, because there's the myths that I grew up with as a Christian, and then there's the myth that those that survived that winnowing effect when I became an atheist, that, you know, of course he wasn't the Son of God, but I still believe that a eyewitness wrote about him. I still believe that we have really good evidence for him. You know, all these presuppositions right through the Christian lens came to me through atheism, including what blows me away now, having, you know, gone over a decade into this, is when you read the stories for the first time, you know, without looking at the Christian presuppositions in them. When you read Mark, our first gospel, our oldest gospel, our most no-frills gospel, and read it as the story of a human guy, a normal guy, who, because he was so obedient to God, became adopted as his son and goes through this whole process where the first thing that happens is he goes through this testing period where he's tested by the devil to see if he's up to the job. And at the end, where he's at the Garden of Gethsemane, really scared about what's going to happen, really afraid of the pain and the death he's going to suffer. He has no idea, you know, what's in store for him. He's not a god. He's still a man. When you read these stories, not only do they not make sense from a Christian standpoint, it's like, what can the devil tempt Jesus with? You know, all the he's just a godling slumming on earth. It makes no sense to be able to tempt him. When you read them and see, here's a guy in the Garden of Gethsemane who says, I'm totally terrified, I'm totally scared, but not my will, but yours. And this is a flesh and blood man saying this. The pathos is so real and so beautiful in a way that it's not when you think, oh, he's just going to have a bad weekend and then go straight back to heaven. You know,
it's interesting because you kind of covered the gamut there. And I want to make sure people get one part in there that you said that almost kind of slips past, and that's that in your second book, Jesus Mything in Action, it's almost like you get to this level two discussion that I think is so interesting, because some of that stuff you're talking about of kind of deconstructing the biblical text, to me, is like the level one. But the level two is so interesting from this analytic standpoint in the way that you just mentioned. So people go through this process, right? And they get into Christian apologetics and they learn this versus that. And then what you've done is distilled that down and said, okay, once you go through this process, what you're likely to come up with is this. Yeah, but Jesus is still one of the most well-sourced persons in history. And you go, okay, you're going to come to that point, and now let's deconstruct that, you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with the Bible per se. It's this meta thing that you've picked up.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted to hear you saying this, because that's exactly what I wanted to do with this book. I wanted to break this down and show that, hey, the evidence points in a completely different direction. Let's look at that first gospel, the gospel that all the others were based upon. Let's find out who wrote these gospels, when they wrote them. You know, there's so many assumptions that go into, oh, well, Jesus had 12 followers and they wrote about him and we have their books. And so, you know, la-di-da-da-da. But when you look at how different Christianity is before those gospels are written, and how different all the four gospels are from each other, and yet how clearly they're taken from the first gospel and just, you know, cut and pasted and gone in off in different directions. And when you realize that this is just the tip of the iceberg, these are just the four that made the official cut into scripture. And there's a whole world of Christian writings from the second century that are floating out there that never made the cut. But then Christians in the second century would think we weren't real Christians because we didn't have all these stories about, you know, infant Jesus growing up in Smallville before he became Superman, you know, and these different takes on Jesus and the incompatibility of each one. No one set out to write a fourth gospel. No one set out to write a second gospel. All these gospel writers were writing the gospel, meant to be the one and only gospel.
Corrected version.
Yeah, exactly. And it is funny because they do correct mistakes that Mark makes in his gospel. And then they go off in completely incompatible directions. But it's fascinating to see that development. Just the evolution of any religion alone is fascinating and enough to debunk it as a purely human thing. And I don't even mean that as a slam. It's fascinating to watch where Christianity really came from and to see the conflicting ideas that were going on between early Christians and proto-Christians and all the things that followed after that, just the ways they were constantly reinventing themselves. And even Christianity itself, so many of when I get into book three, which is basically – I call it the Gospel According to H.G. Wells, and – do a time travel expedition through the origins of Christianity. You see them taking scriptures from the Hebrew scriptures, rebooting it to correct failed prophecies and reinterpret it to work again. You see that and taking the same ones and just leapfrogging through history with them to come up with ways to make this work, these apocalyptic prophecies work. And you see Christianity coming out of this effect and the influence of like Hellenized Jews like Philo of Alexandria and, you know, other religions that we don't even think of having any bearing on Christianity. You totally see where they're coming from.
You do quite a job of, you know, again, people are going to feel a little intimidated by the fact that there's three volumes out there. But it's very readable and it's well organized and you can kind of get to it. And if you are interested in this history, which I think a lot of us should be, I mean, it's so still linked in our culture that I think we should be interested. So,
and it's just fascinating. It's just all things being equal, it's fascinating to read. But I appreciate you saying so. You know, it wasn't meant to be three books at all, actually. It's just when I was done with it, I was talking to my audiobook engineer and saying, okay, this is going to be kind of a big book. It's about almost 600 pages and it's about just over a quarter of a million words. And he says, wait, over 600 pages. Are these 8.5 by 11 pages or are these 6 by 9 pages? And I went, oh no. So when we reformatted for the actual book, it worked out to be almost 900 pages. So
yeah, instead of a quarter of a million words, that's nuts.
Just over a quarter million. But instead of having one big phone book sized book, we broke it down into three very readable volumes. So yeah, don't be daunted by it. And I think the third book is the most fun. Because it's not a talking head. It's telling a story and telling from what we know for sure about early Christianity, what some of the things, you know, showing that evolution. And I feel like I left a lot out of that book because some, we just don't know the dating of these phases of early Christianity. We know that they happened, but did they happen in the 70s? Did they happen in the 90s? Did they happen in the early second century? And so I feel like there's even more room to tell the story. There's more things to put into that story. But I'm really pleased with the way the book is now, and people seem to really like it. So
that's great. It has a lot of great reviews. So where do you go from here then? Is there a volume 4 and 5, or are you done with mythicism?
Well, right now, currently, I'm working on a science fiction trilogy with my wife, and we're on book 2 of that. So I'm contractually obliged to finish that and book 3. But the next nonfiction book I'll be doing is going to be based on my sex and violence talk. I don't know if you've seen that on YouTube.
I haven't.
It's my favorite talk. It's called Sexy Violence, Violent Sex, the Weird-Ass Morality of the Bible. And it's my favorite talk of all the talks I've ever given. And that's going to be the next book in the series, which is the Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion series.
Great. Great. Well, again, our guest has been David Fitzgerald. We've mentioned a couple of his books several times, but we'll hit it one more time. Nailed, which you might have heard about. Quite a splash with that in his latest Jesus Mything in Action. And as you just heard, we got more books to look for from Dave in the future. So it's been great pleasure having you on the show. Thanks again so much for joining.
Right back at you, Alex. Thanks so much. It's been awesome talking to you.
Thanks again to David Fitzgerald for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I guess I tee up from this interview has to do with the cult question. I don't think the cultish aspect of mainstream Christianity gets enough attention. It's as if we talk about cults and then we talk about Christianity, as if there's this huge dividing line. If there is any dividing line, it's certainly fuzzy. Isn't it a lot more fuzzy than we'd like to pretend? So what do you think? Is Christianity a cult? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can also download any of our over 350 previous episodes, or jump on over to the forum and join the discussion over there, or drop me a note or an email, whatever way you find best to connect with me and other people who are listening to this show. So I do have some interesting shows coming up. I'm also slowing down a little bit for the summer, and kind of in general, I'd like to get back to the once every 2 week schedule and see what other things that opens up in my life. So that's my direction, at least temporarily, for the show. But I do, as always, appreciate your listening, appreciate so many of the awesome emails and letters that I get from folks who are appreciative of the show and enjoy connecting with these ideas. It's really such an amazing thing that we can connect in that way. So that's just wonderful, and I hope it continues for a long, long time. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.